From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The policy centrepiece of the federal budget was $17.7 billion over 5 years for aged care, a sector that has been shamefully neglected by governments over a very long time. One of the most important initiatives will be a boost of 80,000 in the number of home care packages, for which demand has been greatly outstripping supply. The aged care policy has prompted some criticism that the money won't be enough, and also sparked debate about whether better off people should contribute more to their care. With us to talk about the policy and these issues is Richard Colbeck, the Minister for Senior Australians and Aged Care Services. In his other role as Minister for Sport, we also talk with him about the Australian team's preparation for the Tokyo Olympics, which are to be conducted despite COVID being rampant in Japan. Richard Colbeck, the government's allocation to aged care of $17.7 billion over 5 years is a big number, but some experts say it won't be enough, that $10 billion a year is needed. What advice was this number based on?
Well, we worked through the recommendations of the Royal Commission. The department provided us with some advice with respect to costings. So, for example, the figure of $10 per bed per day was a figure that was given in evidence to the Royal Commission. It was recommended by the Royal Commission. We accepted the recommendation. We've put some additional funding in to support residential aged care providers with respect to support the workforce, $3.9 billion. So the costings were done based on information we had in the department. And look, there were a lot of numbers flying around the sector in the lead up to the budget. But I'm very comfortable that the figures that we've got in the budget are appropriate for where we are now. You actually do need to look at some of the other elements of the redesign of the system to see where it might go. Because, for example, we will be establishing a new independent hospitals and aged care pricing authority, which will do a cost of delivery of care in a similar way that's done for the health system. And that will be then applied to the sector through the new funding model, through the ANAC model. And that provides, I think, a really important pathway for the sector to understand how they're going to be remunerated for the services that they provide based on that advice from the new authority. And, of course, the staffing elements that go into that will also be designed by a matrix that's been designed to align with the new ANAC funding model.
One funding alternative was to inject more user pays for better off people into the system. Was this ever considered? And if so, why was it not accepted?
Look, we've had a really close look at that, and there's probably more work to do in that space. It isn't a simple exercise. When we're looking at complete redesign of the home care system, and, of course, the reforms that we're already undertaking to residential care, those things can be further contemplated. But I think there's broad acceptance that where people can afford to make a contribution to support them as they age, they should do. So we'll continue to consider that. But at this point in time, there's additional work that we need to do, particularly given that we are also embarking on a redesign of the system of care at home, and that will have implications for it as well.
Now, speaking of care at home, you've announced 80,000 additional home care packages. The waiting list is about 100,000. Why the gap?
Well, it's not a completely linear exercise because the waiting list has been coming down in real terms for a period of time now, which is what we've been seeking to do. But although the waiting list sits at about 96,000 at the moment, a lot of those people already have a home care package but at a lower level to the one that they were assessed as needing. So it's not a direct swap for swap with respect to the waiting list and the number of new home care packages needed. And you also need to consider that this is from the 1st of July this year, and we are currently rolling out new home care packages or offering new home care packages to senior Australians at the rate of about 1,200 per week. So there are still a considerable number of packages to come into the system. We think that on our calculations, this will cover the gap that's required, and those packages will be rolled out while we redesign the system of care at home.
The Royal Commission recommended a maximum wait for home care of 30 days. Can you guarantee the 30-day maximum will be achieved, and what would be the timetable?
Well, we've said that we'll roll these new packages out over the 80,000 packages at the rate of 40,000 a year for the next 2 years while we redesign the new system. And so getting that resolved within that time frame would be our objective.
And so you're pretty certain you can give that guarantee of the 30 days?
Well, if you consider that a high needs level 4 home care package is already sitting at a wait time of 30 days, I think that the objective of that for the entire wait list is certainly achievable.
Of the 80,000 additional packages, how many will be at that level 4 neediest level?
Look, I don't have the specific numbers, but we do have the calculations available for the rollout. So those figures can be made available to you to let you know what they are. I've seen the chart, but I just don't have it with me. But they will be spread across the different package levels to meet the need of people as per the rollout. And, of course, in some circumstances, it may be a reduction in, say, level one packages because some of those are being used for interim packages at the moment. So it will be a rollout of packages at the appropriate levels to meet the national priority list.
On the measure to increase the number of face-to-face minutes to 200 that residents have, the timetable is late 2023 for that to be achieved. That seems very slow.
Well, there's two elements to it. Firstly, we need to continue to increase and grow the workforce. There would be some providers who are there already, I have to say. The figures that are being talked about are average figures. So there's going to be a requirement to attract and train and retain the workforce. But we've allocated $3.9 billion in the budget to support that particular measure. The Royal Commission's recommendation is what we've accepted, and the Royal Commission's recommendation also talks about aligning the number of care minutes that are actually required with the new ANAC funding model and the matrix of care time that goes with that, which is what we've said we'll do, and we've also said that we'll incorporate that into the New Aged Care Act. So it is a process of the redesign of the system, the attraction and the training of the workforce required, and in some circumstances it's going to be a significant additional workforce that's required as part of that process.
How do you attract more people into this workforce? Is it a question of wages, or are other measures going to be necessary? And if it's wages, what does the government do about that? Will it be active in Fair Work representations?
Well, we've said that we will provide any information required to the current Fair Work case that's available. I know that the sector peaks and the unions are in discussions along with the Australian Aged Care Workforce Industry Council as a coordinating body, talking to them with respect to the workforce case. So we'll play a very cooperative role in the case that's currently before Fair Work Australia.
But you're not advocating in that case, are you, for an increase? You're just providing information.
We're providing information as required, and I know that the unions and the sector peaks are working very cooperatively with respect to what their position might be. I think it's the role that we're playing is the appropriate role.
Why not advocate for more?
Well, I think the role that we're playing is the appropriate role, providing all the available and appropriate information for the Commission. One of the Commission's role is to make the judgments that are being made. We'll be very cooperative as a part of that process. And I think the fact that the unions and the sector are working more closely together on this case will be quite influential.
Will this be the definitive case, or will there be more cases in the near term about pay?
Well, I think that there may be some more cases, particularly for different classifications of workforce, nurses in particular. But we've recognised that clinical leadership in particular plays a critical role in the quality of care that's being delivered. In our response to the COVID report, we announced some measures with respect to scholarships that support nurses being trained into the aged care sector. So we're actually supporting the education of nursing staff to support the aged care sector. And we've also, in the budget, announced some workforce bonuses to support people in the sector. So separate scales for full-time workers, $3,700 for a full-time worker and $2,700 for a part-time worker alongside those nursing scholarships. So the nursing capacity and within the system is very important, and so we're clearly working to support that.
You're beefing up the regulator, but its performance has been certainly less than optimal in the past. Did you consider scrapping it and starting again in terms of regulation?
Look, I am concerned about some of the criticisms of the regulator, because if you look at the circumstance of the regulator and where they sat, particularly over the last 18 months, 2 years, we were actually constructing our new regulator. The regulator as it exists now only came into existence at the beginning of January 2020, so last year. So, and we have, over a period of time, continued to give the regulator additional resources, both in terms of financial resources, but the tools that it has to use for regulating the sector. The Royal Commission's made a number of recommendations with respect to that. We will provide them with additional tools. In fact, I had commissioned a piece of work by the Advisory Council to the Quality Commission back in November of 19 about what additional tools the regulator might need. We'd actually legislated some of those tools as a part of the Serious Incident Response Scheme, and we'll expand those in new legislation more broadly across the sector. So it's a matter of the regulator settling into its new entity, which is only 15 or 16 months old now. So I think some of the criticism that's been made of the regulator is quite unfair, given that they came into existence on the 1st of January and then had to deal with a pandemic within only months. Some of the work that they've done with the sector over the last 12 months has been excellent. Their reviewing of the circumstances in Victoria has been very constructive and useful to the sector, and we'll provide them with additional tools so that they do have the powers that they need in accordance with the recommendations of the Royal Commission.
Now, you're bringing in a new Aged Care Act. When would you expect that to be through Parliament?
The objective is to have that resolved in 2 years' time.
And just before we move off aged care, the vaccine rollout into the aged care sector, what's the percentage of people, residents and carers who are now vaccinated or at least have had one shot?
It's well into the 80s. It's probably close to 90% by the stage of this week. Our objective is to have everybody had a first shot by the end of next week.
That's residents or carers?
that's residents, have their first shots completed by the end of the next week. There may be a few providers who, for particular reasons, perhaps they've got a gastro outbreak within the facility, or they have scheduled their flu shots, which have been subject to public health orders in some states that haven't been finalised. But within the next couple of weeks, we're expecting that all residents will have had their first shot, and of course their second shot of Pfizer will follow 3 weeks behind that. And we have now a number of different pathways for workforce to be vaccinated, bearing in mind we had to have a fairly significant reset of the workforce rollout due to advice that we received, and particularly out of the US with respect to vaccinating staff and residents at the same time, recommendation from our health advisors that we not do that. And then, of course, we've had to deal with the health advice with respect to people receiving the AstraZeneca vaccine 50 and over. We now have a number of pathways for aged care workforce to get vaccinated. Some of those will be in reach, where providers have arrangements with GPs, for example, to come in and do vaccinations for AstraZeneca in a facility, access to state-based Pfizer clinics, and of course, the GP workforce also is available to the sector now, along with some of our GP clinics.
Do you have a percentage for the workforce?
Look, I don't, and it's because of the difficulty of recording this. We're actually working with the sector right now to generate a mechanism to actively measure that. So we do have figures for those who have been vaccinated as a part of the daily or the in-reach that we've been doing with residents, where there might have been some spare vaccine that's been provided to the workforce. And we're sitting at around 40,000, I think, that have had a first dose of Pfizer as part of that in-reach process. But there's still some work to do there. But the measurement of the actual measurement and recording and reporting, we're working to resolve with the providers at the moment, so that we can get a good indication of where that sits, because it's actually the providers, given the different methods of vaccination, that will hold that information.
But turning now, Richard Colbeck, to what must be the easier part of your responsibilities, your work as sports minister, and of course all the attention is now on the Tokyo Olympics. There's a lot of opposition in Japan to those going ahead. Are you confident that the Games will be staged?
All the messages that I've received is that they will. Obviously, at the end of the day, that's a decision for the Japanese government and the IOC, but all of the feedback, all of the information that I've been receiving at this point in time is that they will go ahead. And, of course, our athletes have to prepare and plan as if that's the case, because they need to be in the best possible shape to compete.
Some people in the torch relay, for example, have already tested positive for COVID. Are you confident that our athletes will be safe?
Well, that's one of the reasons that we've provided access to the vaccine for the team. We need to make sure that everything is done that is possible to do that. We're watching very closely the playbooks that the organising committee are developing to manage the event in a COVID environment. I think it's inevitable that there will be COVID at the Olympics. And so our Olympians and the officials that attend with them are going to have to be very vigilant with respect to their personal hygiene, the way that they manage themselves, observing social distancing, all of the things that we've been talking about since COVID came upon us. So I'm expecting that there will be COVID there. I think that we all ought to be operating as though it will. And, of course, the circumstances of its presence and whether it spreads in an uncontrolled way will have an impact on the Games themselves, I think. But certainly the advice to our Olympians through the Australian Institute of Sport and the Australian Olympic Committee has been very strong with respect to the way that they conduct themselves and the way that they observe social distancing rules. And that's going to be very important for them and for the Games.
And if any of our athletes do test positive, what provision is there to look after them?
So the organising committee, as I'm advised, has arrangements to care for any athlete who, or any person who's there on a delegation to test positive. They'll be taken to a facility where they'll be isolated from others, of course, and receive the appropriate treatment.
And will there be Australian doctors as part of that effort?
Look, I don't have that level of detail, but certainly there will be medical staff travelling with the Australian team. And I have to say the work that I've seen done, particularly by the medical team at the Australian Institute of Sport, has been first class. And in managing COVID and sport more generally, I think world leading.
And we're about to get some news quite soon, aren't we, on the Brisbane bid for the 2032 Olympics. Brisbane has been designated the preferred candidate city. Where does all that stand? Does that mean that Brisbane has got those games?
No, we still have some work to do. In fact, the bid group presented to the IOC over 3 days during budget week, so Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of budget week, the bid team made a range of different presentations, some of which the federal government, I participated in during that period of time. There are some additional final bid documents that need to be prepared and forwarded to the IOC, and the IOC will then decide whether they make a final decision in mid-July. So it may very well be that that's when the decision's made, but there's still a bit of work to do for the bid team yet.
Now, just on the games, the immediate games, are you intending to go to Tokyo?
Final decision hasn't been made on that. The IOC has asked that Australia has representatives there for a decision on the awarding of the games or otherwise. So that's part of the final decision-making we're considering right now.
And just finally, maybe one of the most divisive issues of the Olympics from the Australians' point of view is the recently revealed Australian team outfits. Where do you stand in this controversy, Daggy or Sheik?
Look, I'm with the athletes as to what they're comfortable with, to be frank. I wouldn't regard myself as a fashionista, and I doubt that anyone else would put me in that category either. So as long as the athletes are comfortable...
You underestimate yourself.
As long as the athletes are comfortable, this is a big deal, a big event for them. If the athletes are happy with their outfits, I'm very comfortable with that.
Richard Colbeck, thank you very much for talking with the Politics Podcast today. And that's all for this week. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassy. We'll be back again with another interview soon. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.